Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 2, Crowley Golden and the Isis Heart, a tale of Egyptian revival, written and performed for podcast by MJ Hahn. Good evening. Welcome to episode 3, and thanks for tuning in. So, listeners, last time we were tagging along with Crowley Golden and his father on their way back to the city. We learned a few details about Crowley, most notably that he's getting late-night text messages from someone named Wilshire Sutton. Then we swung by the Legion of Honor, where the Goldens found the supernatural remnants of a mysterious break-in, including a scorch mark that had previously been Tina Bleiberman. In secret, Crowley did his thing and managed to summon Tina back, yet she wasn't exactly thankful. In her oh-so-subtle way, Tina had insisted that Derventor had returned. As we fade in, it's the morning after, and our friend Yuki O'Malley is in her new living room with her eyes glued to the TV. Oh, did I mention that Crowley and Yuki aren't speaking to each other? Perhaps now we can get to the bottom of things, with as little high school drama as possible. Chapter 3, Derventor's Bequest. On an especially foggy morning, Yuki O'Malley was deeply entrenched in the sofa, remote in hand. In the center of the new, stylishly modern coffee table sat her cell phone, which incidentally hadn't been switched on for weeks. Somewhere upstairs, Yuki could barely hear the doctor shuffling around, getting ready for her day. It was one of the great things about the new house on Green Street. It was big enough for both of them to maintain neutral corners, which had certainly come in handy lately. The other main perk about the place was that it was completely ghost-free. Nothing sinister had ever happened there, and it was too new to have collected any residual history. Something which was pretty significant for Yuki, since she had a tendency to notice such things. Yuki's eyes shot back to the large flat screen. The morning news had started, and Yuki was surprised to recognize her former neighborhood in the background behind the mustached reporter. She fumbled with the volume control on the remote while the doctor descended the stairs in the distance.
This is Chase Burnham for Action 6 City News, coming to you live from Nob Hill. While San Francisco continues to hang under a persistent foggy gloom, an overnight crime spree seems to have spread across the city that has authorities baffled. The evening's events kicked off at the Legion of Honor after the gala opening for a new exhibit. Rumors of a mysterious break-in have been circulating, yet authorities are tight-lipped about any details and have yet to release a full statement. Then, across town, sometime around midnight, a rash of break-ins all along H Street were reported. Police have confirmed that security alarms for at least 12 different businesses were activated, one after the other. Yet the crime scene has provided little in the way of evidence. The only common thread seems to be that the thieves were looking for jewelry, although nothing appears to have been actually stolen. But the odd thing is that there are no signs of forced entry. It looks like whomever was responsible could literally walk through walls. A river of shattered glass now litters the street. Strangely enough, in each case, store windows were smashed not in, but out onto the street. The rampage seems to have culminated at a little antique shop here on Nob Hill, a recent addition to the neighborhood, famously associated with the Coil House fire last year. The shop's proprietor, Irving Bloom, reported the incident, another robbery where jewelry was the apparent target. Luckily, however, in this case, Mr. Bloom was able to get a good look at one of the suspects.
Well, I never. Some hopped-up teenager with this dreadful blue hair just pops up out of nowhere and helps herself to my priceless 19th-century tiara. Then she went and smashed out all my windows.
That's all she took? Just the tiara?
Well, isn't that enough? It's a very, very rare item. Why, it belonged to Lady Blavatsky. It was a gift from the Baron Derventor himself.
Yuki snickered at the reporter's clueless expression while the camera swung around and moved out onto the street, revealing the antique shop's broken windows. You could just see the construction going on across the street, but the new Curse Castle was completely obscured by a massive scaffolding. Yuki watched the camera pan back towards the antique shop. It lingered on the building next door for a moment, The ritzy tea shop that had replaced the Golden Calf had suffered a similar fate. All the windows had been blown out. Broken glass entirely covered the sidewalk like a glistening carpet. The camera moved back to the reporter, who was trying to get a word in edgewise, while Mr. Bloom chittered on about the tea shop next door.
And then I hear her smashing everything up over there while she's screaming her head off, saying, "What's all this? What's all this? Die, yuppie scum, die!" I mean, who says that anymore?
Yuki chuckled while she hit the mute button. Mrs. Fleck's friend, Mr. Bloom, was certainly a character, yet Yuki could barely believe her ears. She didn't have to think very long to have an idea whom Mr. Bloom might be speaking of. In fact, only one blue-haired Hellraiser came to mind. Tina Bleiberman. Yuki had to wonder. It had been a little while since she had spoken to Tina. She wasn't even sure if she'd ever mentioned that the cafe had been sold or that the Goldens had moved. But still, it didn't seem like the kind of thing that would set Tina off on a rampage across the city. Yuki looked back to the TV. Mr. Bloom's interview had ended, replaced by ecstatically serene faces selling peace of mind via aromatherapy laundry soap. Yuki turned around on the sofa as the doctor came clomping down the stairs looking a little frantic. She was carrying an armful of files and a rather overladen tote bag.
"Did you hear that? Mr. Bloom had something stolen that belonged to Derwinter."
The doctor began zooming around the kitchen, assembling a quick breakfast.
"Oh yeah, I've already heard all about it. What a night. Poor Merity is frantic. First Joe gets tossed around at the museum, then Irving goes and gets his priceless tiara swiped."
Derwinter's tiara?
"Well, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't Desmond's."
Yuki was silent and turned back to the TV. Just hearing the doctor mention Derwinter's name so casually made her shudder, like he had been some kindly old relative. Well, at least he got 2 out of 3.
"Oh no. Speaking of Derwinter, I forgot all about this."
Yuki looked over and raised an eyebrow. The doctor stood frozen with a manila envelope in her hand. Yuki could read the return address from across the room. Dermal and Femur.
Uh-oh. What do they want?
"It's about the storage space. You know, all the stuff that Desmond left us. I was just going to donate it all, but I thought maybe we should look through it and see if there was anything worth keeping."
Yuki's brows knitted together and her expression darkened.
I don't want anything that belonged to Derwinter."
"Calm down, lady. I just want to look around. Why don't you meet me over there later? Won't take very long, and we can get some dinner someplace after, okay?"
Yuki rolled her eyes and sunk into the sofa.
"Oh, come on. You've been cooped up here far too long. It'll be good to get out of the house. Mom says so."
While Yuki grumbled into the sofa cushions, the doctor scribbled down an address. Then she slung her tote bag over her shoulder and balanced an enormous commuter mug of coffee on her paperwork while her free hand fumbled with her car keys.
"Okay, lady. I'll be at the lab all day. I've got my cell, so call me if you need me. I'll see you later, okay?"
Yuki grunted from the sofa while the doctor disappeared down the steps that led to the garage. The doctor's words echoed in Yuki's head.
"Oh, come on. You've been cooped up here far too long.
It was true. So far, Yuki's summer vacation had amounted to little more than being sequestered around the clock in front of the TV. Which was just fine as far as Yuki was concerned. TV reality was way better than what was going on outside in the real world. Especially a world full of evil, backstabbing, conniving teenagers. Yuki aimed the remote and began purposely flicking through channel after channel, while her freshman year at Veracity High seized her memory yet again. It had all started well enough. Veracity High School was the picture of private, prestigious perfection. It spanned an entire block of pricey Pacific Heights real estate. The campus was comprised of 3 mansions linked together. The East Building, called St. Ursula's, held classes for the girls, while the West Building, known as Sutton Hall, accommodated the boys' classrooms. The Central Building, or what had been the former Flood Mansion, housed general assemblies as well as special functions. Aside from the amazing campus, which offered panoramic views of the bay, Veracity boasted an advanced curriculum and a consistent 100% college acceptance rate. And then along came Yuki. Perhaps her past experience of being privately tutored while the doctor moved from job to job had left her with a slightly skewed idea of what school was supposed to be like. When the doctor had been with Kokuyama Corporation in Tokyo, the facility had provided for small groups of children to be taught together. but that hadn't readied Yuki in the slightest for what lay ahead. Not to say that her scores on Veracity's assessment tests weren't exemplary. In fact, Yuki was glaringly gifted. She could have walked out with her GED then and there, cheerfully skipping the whole high school nightmare entirely. It was at this point that the doctor had intervened. Apparently, it was deemed that Yuki had missed out on too much normal kid stuff already, even more so now that they were settled and had the whole Curse Castle business behind them. The doctor was determined to dole out as much normality as possible. And so dotted lines were signed, and Yuki was put on the college prep fast track. All well and good until Yuki's personal file had fallen into the wrong hands.
Ugh, Wilshire Sutton.
Yuki had heard whisperings about them. She'd even seen them represented in the movies, but none of that had prepared her for the real thing. The villain that nobody saw coming, the angelic face that lied through its perfectly straight white teeth, the evil skank beast of the senior class that led every boy in school around by the nose. Wilshire Sutton, the devil in the form of a 17-year-old quintessentially all-American blonde high school cheerleader. Yuki's first run-in with Wilshire had been during the first week of school when she had to sit in front of her during calculus. Naturally, everyone had looked at Yuki with curiosity. A freshman in a senior class? During that first day, the other girls seemed friendly, even genuinely interested in hearing about Yuki's travels. Clearly, this didn't sit well with Wilshire. Because in the following weeks, something had changed. Suddenly, the other girls began to smirk at Yuki when they saw her, only to burst out laughing when they were a short distance away. Lunch hour was the worst, when everyone around would suddenly get the same text message and laugh in unison, except for Yuki, who couldn't help feeling that she was the brunt of the joke. This had happened often enough so that Yuki had ended up taking her lunches and any free time that she had hidden away in the art department with the gloomy, black-clad foreign exchange students. Soon after, even they seemed to look at her strangely. This final blow sent Yuki venturing across campus to Sutton Hall, where she sought the consolatory shoulder of her best friend, Crowley Golden. Crowley's sophomore year had been going pretty smoothly, comparatively speaking. He only chuckled and didn't seem very surprised that a war was storming over at St. Ursula's. In fact, he seemed a little underwhelmed.
Come on, it is high school after all. Duh.
Yuki may have been a little more receptive to this theory if Wilshire Sutton hadn't happened to have walked by just as Crowley had said it. If Yuki hadn't seen the way Crowley's eyes zeroed in on Wilshire's sun-kissed tresses and followed them as they silkily drifted away, leaving behind the delicate scent of baby powder gently wafting on the breeze. Yeah, she might have listened. But as the months went by, things only seemed to get worse. In March, when Yuki's birthday had rolled around, the whole evil business came to a head. The plan was just a simple get-together at the new Green Street house. The doctor had even agreed to make herself scarce. It was just going to be a movie and some pizza with the foreign exchange students in Crowley. Just an easy, fun night. But it hadn't exactly ended up that way. Hours had dragged by, and still none of Yuki's guests had arrived. Then, when Yuki tried to call Crowley to see what was going on, the call was answered, but not by Crowley. In a series of barely intelligible giggles, Wilshire Sutton informed Yuki that Crowley Golden was unavailable and would she like to leave a message. Pure hatred flared up in Yuki, preventing her from offering a response. There was just more giggling until Wilshire eventually hung up. Shortly after, while Yuki was still waiting for an apology, she heard a rumor around school that Wilshire Sutton was now dating a younger classmate. She didn't have to guess who. After his defection to Camp Sutton, Yuki had never heard from Crowley again. After sleeping the day away, Yuki awoke and found herself still embedded in the sofa. The last meager rays of sunlight were disappearing over the horizon, which was slowly being engulfed in a large fog bank. With a start, Yuki glanced at the clock. It was nearly 7. She grabbed her phone and ran around the house, throwing a few things into her backpack. She pulled on a sweatshirt and tucked her long hair under the hood. Then she dashed out into the fog. Fortunately, the address that the doctor had written down wasn't too far away, just a few blocks, actually. Yuki was now pretty familiar with all of the out-of-the-way stairwells that snaked out of Telegraph Hill down into North Beach and downtown. She was able to navigate a quick network of shortcuts and side streets, just like a local. A short time later, just as night fell, Yuki found herself in the heart of the old Barbary Coast. She was standing outside of a large brick building with tall arched windows that towered high above. A large faded sign read, "Safe and Sound Storage." Yuki spotted the doctor standing by the front doors, noting that she was in the company of an odd, pale little man, wearing sunglasses and a rather old-fashioned black suit.
"Hi, lady. I was just about to send out a search party."
"Oh, ha ha. I got down here as quick as I could."
"So, have you met Mr. Femur?"
"Lovely to see you again, my dear."
Yuki nodded mutely, and the slight man lowered his sunglasses. His pale eyes were lit by an all-too-familiar opalescence. Although they may have never been officially introduced, Yuki certainly knew who Mr. Femur was. She had seen both him and his equally off-putting law partner, Mr. Dermal, on a few occasions, including one of her visions the previous year where she had visited the Curse Castle in 1885. The really odd thing was that it appeared that Mr. Femur still hadn't aged a day since then. Mr. Femur handed over a rather sizable stack of papers to the doctor while he fiddled with the keys to the enormous warehouse. The doctor began flipping through the extensive list of items.
"Well, it looks like this might take longer than we thought."
Mr. Femur pulled the large doors open and flipped on the lights, revealing the warehouse's cavernous interior. The doctor entered, completely absorbed with the long inventory, while Yuki trailed closely behind, giving Mr. Femur as wide a berth as possible. The space was divided into narrow aisles that ran between large numbered cubicles made of chain-link fence that ran clear to the ceiling. Yuki could see the jumbled silhouettes of countless stacked items that went on as far as the eye could see.
"We should get started. There's quite a bit to get through. Sorry, I didn't realize it was all three floors."
Not to worry, Cherub. The bulk of the noteworthy items are here on the ground floor. We'll get through it in a trice."
Mr. Femur had resumed control of the inventory list. He studied the first few pages while removing a fountain pen from his breast pocket. His thin lips curled into a tight little smile.
Yes. Desmond did enjoy his little extravagances. Oh, look, there are several Chippendale cabinets hidden in here somewhere. Let's be sure to keep an eye out for those."
Mr. Femur and the doctor began picking through the mess. Yuki had to suppress a chuckle at Mr. Femur's wheezing gasps of astonishment every time a dust cloth was pulled back. He was like a greedy child in Aladdin's cave. The vast collection had also cast some sort of spell on the doctor. She looked a little nostalgic and merely nodded slightly as each new piece was revealed. This convenient distraction made it easy for Yuki to break away and do a little exploring on her own. She decided that the stairs looked like a good place to start. One flight later, the view from the top of the stairs was almost identical to the floor below, a vast chamber with crowded rows of caged collectibles. Again, each cubicle was crammed full, nearly to the ceiling. Only on this floor, the items seemed to be from more recent decades. There were some modern pieces and even a few garish examples of psychedelia peeking out from behind the back of a few of the stacks. After a quick walkthrough, Yuki continued onward and upward. The third floor was comparatively cozy and more or less empty. No chain-link cages here, just an open space with one wall comprised of 3 15-foot floor-to-ceiling arched windows. The drifting blanket of fog outside parted, revealing a bright full moon that cast the room into sharp relief. The shadows from the window panes shot across the floor like spiderwebs. In the moonlight, Yuki noted a solitary cluster of crates and a large cardboard box arranged neatly in one corner. Yuki moved over to investigate. Her footsteps disturbed a thick layer of dust on the floor that shimmered in the silvery light, which was bright enough to read by. Yuki gasped when she was close enough to see that all the crates were stenciled with a familiar name. Golden. Yuki's brow furrowed. Even though it was the last thing she had expected to find, she couldn't honestly say that she was surprised. Yuki revisited 1885 once again, remembering her visions of Vernal Golden and Derventor's collaboration. She also remembered that this partnership hadn't exactly had a happy ending, having seen Golden stomp out taking most of his inventions with him. Yuki looked back at the stack of crates,
wondering what they could possibly contain.
Derwinter would have found a way to keep something for himself.
The cardboard box sat partially open, and Yuki peeled back one of the flaps. A jumble of objects was piled inside. Coils of wire, a few screwdrivers and wrenches, a number of small containers that were full of nuts and bolts. And then a large rectangular wad of muslin caught Yuki's eye. She reached for it and realized it was a book. Her curiosity piqued, Yuki carefully unwrapped the layers of dusty cloth until she held the leather-bound journal. She opened it, and was surprised when the name that she had expected to find was only partially correct. The journal had, in fact, belonged to a golden. Only a golden that Yuki had actually met relatively recently.
Theodorus Golden, Crowley's grandfather.
Yuki flipped through the journal's pages, remembering the few occasions that she had visited the huge house up in Ashbury Heights. Grandpa Theo, as he insisted on being called, was every bit as eccentric as the rest of the men in his family, and his journal didn't indicate otherwise. Page after page detailing some strange process of energy transfer. She flipped past detailed schematics for some unusual devices, such as a phantasmal cell and a large black metal cylinder called the extractor. Yuki closed the journal with a little puff of dust. She reached into the cardboard box, retrieving one of the screwdrivers, and turned her attention to one of the wooden crates. The top pried off easily enough, and at first glance the crate's contents weren't exactly overwhelming. Nestled in a bed of withered raffia was what looked like a collection of old soda cans. Yuki scoffed at the sight, wondering why someone would go to such lengths to store a bunch of recycling. Then, upon closer inspection, Yuki raised an eyebrow. It had only been the general shape that had given that meager first impression. Beneath the years of tarnish, there was a dull sheen of brass. Yuki picked up one of the canisters, noting its unexpected heft and then appreciating its fine handcrafted workmanship. A delicate lattice ran along the center, encasing a cylinder of tightly woven wire mesh. One end was perfectly smooth, while the other had a small circular divot that housed two metal prongs. Yuki's brow furrowed. If she didn't know better, it looked like she had found a case of homemade batteries. And while Yuki continued to turn the strange object over in her hands, she failed to notice that the temperature had dropped. The bits of raffia that littered the floor began to flutter on the cold draft that had begun to blow through the room. Suddenly, Yuki dropped the cylinder like it had stung her. She watched it twitch and sputter in the crate like it had come to life. The other cylinders in the crate followed suit, rattling against each other like angry insects. Yuki's shocked expression was gradually illuminated by a dull blue-green light that got steadily brighter from inside the crate. It's worth mentioning here that the blue-haired, semi-transparent 16-year-old girl with the rather formidable combat boots who had just appeared out of thin air behind Yuki had so far gone completely unnoticed. With a start, Yuki spun around, then quickly collected herself upon seeing who had suddenly arrived. The crate of steadily glowing cylinders was temporarily forgotten.
You know, that never gets old.
Oh, watch out! Someone's in a bitchy mood. And I don't know, dressed up special and everything.
Indeed, it was a dazzling display. Yuki couldn't help noticing that Tina's usual vintage street punk attire was now embellished with a glinting gaudy tiara of silver filigree crowded with polished purple crystals.
Wow. Gee, Tina, I never thought of you as the tiara type.
Yeah, well, I may not be a girl, but this thing is chock full of goodness. 59 amethysts. Count them. And this ain't some lame hippie crystal. The power grade is through the roof. You should see the fireballs.
Tina struck her best Bruce Lee kung fu pose, while Yuki rolled her eyes.
That's okay. Maybe some other time. So, all those broken windows on Hate Street, that was you, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I was having a moment. Guess I don't know my own strength.
Mm-hmm. And the antique shop on Nob Hill, that was you as well?
Aw, shucks. You're making me blush.
No, that guy is a really good friend of Mrs. Flack.
Who? Miss Pitts at the antique shop? You gotta be kidding me.
Nope, no joke. It was on the news and everything. And actually, I think he mentioned that very tiara.
What? This old thing?
Yep, and believe it or not, it belonged to Derwinter's family. It's like a priceless heirloom or something.
Cool. Sounds like payback to me.
Wasn't burning the house down payback enough?
Huh? Oh, that. please, catch up, honey. I'm talking about what went down last night at the friggin' Legion of Honor.
Tina launched into a lengthy, detailed tirade about the previous night's events. How she had fended off an army of zombie skeleton jewel thieves, only to be vanquished by a cheap shot from some black-cloaked blimp-riding guy, who looked an awful lot like someone they both knew all too well.
Huh. They didn't exactly mention zombie skeletons on the news.
Duh. No surprise there.
And this guy in the cloak. You really think it was Derventor?
Well, I thought so. He kind of looked the same, but was way cooler. All I know is that he kicked my ass with a silver pistol that seemed pretty familiar. Good thing Crowley was there to fix me up.
Yuki's expression suddenly went a little stony.
Oh, you saw Crowley?
Yes, I saw Crowley. And guess what? He says, hey.
Oh, does he?
Yuki's lips disappeared into a thin, hard line, while Tina threw up her hands in exasperation.
Ugh, you too! Would you just get over yourselves? This whole high school drama thing is really tired. Okay, whatever. I can see I'm wasting my time here.
While Yuki stood with her arms folded, a cold wind suddenly whipped through the room. Every one of the 59 amethysts in Tina's tiara sparked up, ablaze with purple light. Tina vanished in a flash and a final blast of cold air. Yuki toppled over backwards, colliding into the stack of wooden crates behind her. Glowing brass canisters were sent careering off across the floor in all directions like a swarm of bulky fireflies. And somewhere in the swirling air, Yuki thought she could still hear Tina's voice echoing out.
Just calm already!
After things had calmed down, Yuki had gotten to her feet, looking slightly disheveled, while noticing that the strange phosphorescence within the canisters seemed to be dimming. She picked one up and examined it closer. The pale blue-green light grew weaker until it faded, then winked out altogether, like a flashlight with a battery that had finally run dry. She held the thing in her hand, completely puzzled as to what it could be. Well, that shouldn't be a surprise, considering her history with the Golden Family thus far. Yuki collected the remaining scattered canisters and returned them to their crate, except for two, which she stowed in her backpack next to Theodorus Golden's journal. Yuki was still pretty sure that she wasn't in a big hurry to talk to Crowley anytime soon, but just in case they happened to, say, bump into each other sometime, at least she would have something new to talk about. After dusting herself off as best she could, Yuki smoothed her hair down and hoisted the backpack over her shoulder. She turned back towards the stairs and then rolled her eyes. She could hear the doctor being witty, followed by Mr. Femur's reedy laugh drifting up from below. Later that evening, back on Nob Hill, Irving Bloom had just finished an exhausting day cleaning up the chaos that had been wrought in his tiny antique shop. He looked askance at the new sheets of plywood that now covered his front windows while he shuffled to the shop's tiny back room. After he had hung up his broom and dustpan, the delicate tinkle of the little bell over the front door rang out, which was strange because Irving Bloom was definitely sure that he'd had the front door locked all day. He peeked out from behind the silk velvet curtain that hung behind his counter, and was shocked to see the rather severe-looking woman standing in the shop's doorway. She tossed her long, blonde waves over her bony shoulder.
"Good evening, Mr. Bloom. I saw you on the news earlier, and I felt compelled to pay you a visit. Well, I'm sorry, but we're closed. I've had a busy day, as you can plainly see." "Ah, of course. How thoughtless of me. Well, I'll get right to the point then. I understand that a valuable piece was recently stolen from the premises."
Irving Bloom looked slightly taken aback. His nostrils twitched involuntarily at the sharp scent of noxious gardenia that clung to the woman like a miasma.
Well, yes, I suppose. A rare tiara from an old family."
The stranger approached, bringing her heavily painted features into the light. Beneath the blonde curls, the woman's pale golden eyes burned with yellow fire. Mr. Bloom's professional eye was first drawn to the large golden ankh that hung around the woman's neck. Even from a distance, he could tell it was very old and very valuable. He looked up expectantly and was unprepared for the gaze which was there to greet him.
Mr. Bloom's posture slackened, and his eyes went slightly out of focus.
Now then, Mr. Bloom, about the tiara, you were saying? Oh yes, a rare ornament indeed. It belonged to the Lady Blavatsky, who of course was a spiritualist of some note in the 1800s.
The stranger's posture stiffened. Then, as if suddenly aware of this, she relaxed her manner once again.
Yes, quite. But I believe you mentioned another name. I'd be very interested to hear any details that you might have to offer about that. About the Baron Derwinter?
Mr. Bloom spluttered, managing to look a little wary.
The Baron? Well, it's a rather infamous tale.
The yellow fire in Audra Lamal's eyes flashed.
Mr. Bloom. Humor me. I do love a good family history.
And so, Chapter 3 comes to a close. I'd like to thank guest voices on this episode, Sally Clausen as the Doctor, Lisa Snare as Tina, and Leanne Parker as Yuki. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and at comptech.com. I'd also like to thank Random Coil UK for their cover of Satie's Nacien No. 1. Please stay tuned for Chapter 4. And until then, this is MJ Han saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.